So shifting gears a little bit, I'm going to be talking about working with schools and some of the school-based trials that we did addressing social impairment and sort of moving from intervention development to implementation. So we know that social impairment is one of the most challenging and least malleable core deficits for children with autism. And in my opinion, it's one of the hardest skills for us to teach and one of the hardest skills for our children to master. And traditionally, interventions that address social impairment have been delivered in university-based or clinic settings. And they're typically focused in large groups where many children with autism come together and they work on specific skills. And while they've shown great efficacy in improving skills, they're limited in their generalizability. Especially if you take those kids and put them in their schools, they have difficulty kind of using the skills that they've learned and applying them to peers at school. So we thought we would take our interventions and move them to schools, and that would aid in the generalization and maintenance of those skills. And it's really unique for us to work with schools because we get a different set of outcomes that we can measure. So things that are related to the classroom, we get to see what the kids look like in the classroom, in the cafeteria, in the hallway, on the playground, in different sets of contexts, as well as with different people. So who are they interacting with, what peers, what do those interactions look like, how are their relationships with their teachers and other adults in the building. But when we work with schools, we need to reset our expectations. Oftentimes, schools, unfortunately, do not view socialization as falling within their purview. We've been in countless number of schools where they've said no thank you to our program because we weren't focused on academics or behavior or safety. And we also have to reset our expectations. And you're probably wondering why I'm showing you a picture of a parking lot, but that's actually one of our playgrounds that doubles as a teacher's parking lot. And so when we go into some of these lower income schools, we really need to work with what they have and reset those expectations that we bring to the schools. So what we planned. Our first trial was a partial effectiveness trial where we worked with 60 high-functioning children with autism who were fully included in general education classrooms for 80% more of the school day. We were in 56 classrooms in 30 different schools. A little over half of these schools were considered Title I schools, meaning that they were in lower income and under-resourced neighborhoods. And in the interest of time, and also because I really want to focus on what it is that we learned from these trials, I'm not going to talk in too much detail about the interventions, but if you guys should have specific questions, please feel free to ask me afterwards. But we randomized children to one of four conditions. The first one was a child-assisted condition where we worked one-on-one with the student with autism. The second was a peer-mediated treatment where we worked indirectly with the child by working with three of his or her peers from the classroom. And then we did a combined treatment where one interventionist worked with the child with autism and another interventionist worked with three of his or her peers. And then there was a no-treatment waitlist control, and these students were randomized in active treatment 12 weeks later. So we intervened twice a week for 6 weeks during recess and lunch, and our goal was to use a developmental approach to enhance skills, but applying those skills with their peers at school. And our objective was to increase children's social inclusion and their engagement with peers. And how we measured social inclusion, we asked the children three simple questions. Who do you like to hang out with? Who do you not like to hang out with? And who do you see hanging out together in groups? And we also measured children's playground engagement. So we had blind observers go out at baseline, once a week during treatment, at exit, and also at the follow-up, to rate children's engagement with peers and also their social communicative behaviors on the playground. So what we saw, if I can aim this is what we call a social network map. And essentially, it's a diagram of the classroom social connectiveness. If I could point this. So the letters and numbers are the IDs, and the numbers in the parentheses are what we call the individual centrality. So that's how often they were nominated to any peer group. So from those three questions that I told you about, the last question, who do you see hanging out together in groups, generates this map. So for example, if Connie was my target child, we would count up the number of times she was nominated to any peer group, and that would be her individual salience in the classroom, so how popular and nominated she was on an individual level. The numbers in the diagrams are their cluster centrality, and that's how salient you are as group members. So the kids you're connected with, how salient are they in the classroom? So when we look at this at baseline, this was my fifth grader who was randomized to a peer-mediated treatment. She was an isolate. So these categorizations, they generate four classifications. At the very bottom are kids that are isolated. So they were not nominated to any peer group. The kids just either neglected to mention them or just forgot to mention them, but they weren't connected to any other child in the classroom. The next step up would be the peripheral kids, and those are the kids, like these kids, who are on the outskirts of their classroom social network. They might have a few connections here and there, but they're at the bottom 30% of their classroom as far as their salience. And then the next step up would be secondary, and those kids are the ones that are very well grounded in their classroom, the middle 40% of nominations, but they're not the most popular kids in the classroom. And lastly, there's the higher upper echelon of the classroom, and those are the top 30%, and those are the kids that are considered nuclear. So they're the most, for lack of a better word, popular kids in the class. So the kids highlighted in bold red are the three peer models that were nominated by the teacher to participate in our intervention. And you can see at baseline, they weren't connected with each other and they were not connected with the student with autism. At exit, sorry that you can't really see that. Sorry, David. So that's our kiddo with autism. And you can see in just 6 weeks, we were able to change these networks. The networks themselves are very fluid and they do move, but we were able to include her into a network with three of her typical peers, and the two peers were connected to each other as well. And so the idea really is that we didn't have much time to change their social inclusion, but it's possible. It took a lot of hard work, but it definitely did work. And at follow-up, our kiddo is over there. And you can see that her social salience dropped a little bit. So she moved from isolated to secondary, and at the 12-week follow-up, she dropped to peripheral. The good news is she's still connected to her peers. The bad news is after our team left, so the support she was receiving after we withdrew that, you can see that her results kind of dropped a little bit. Although she's still connected to two of her peers, so that's great. So what it looks like in a large graphical interpretation, you can't see the background overlays, but the graph on the left-hand side, that's when we compare the peer-mediated treatment to the non-peer-mediated treatment, so all the kids that receive some sort of peer-mediated component at exit and at follow-up, you can see that there are significant differences as far as their social inclusion. Whereas when we look at the child-assisted treatments, so working one-on-one with the student with autism, there were no differences at exit and at follow-up. So what we did next, our next randomized controlled trial was another partial effectiveness trial, and this time we employed a group design, and this was funded through the Health Resources Services Administration, the Autism Intervention Research Network and Behavioral Health, what a mouthful, and we decided that a group design might be more feasible for schools to implement because they can see a lot more kids during one setting. So we compared a skill-based group to an engagement-based group. And for the skill-based group, we really worked with students only on the autism spectrum or that had other social needs. There were no typically developing children in that group. And we worked on specific skills like building a conversation, how to initiate, how to respond, how to detect the difference between a world wonder and a social wonder. And that we compared those to an engagement-based group where kids with autism were included in a group with their typically developing peers. And again, we thought that this would be a more feasible and realistic model for schools to implement once our team left. And it was twice a week for 8 weeks at lunchtime or recess time. And again, we're comparing the two groups. And these data are still being analyzed, but the important thing to note is that we learned a lot from conducting these two trials, and in this trial, we were only in under-resourced schools. So addressing sustainability, I touched on that our kiddos dropped a little bit as far as their social inclusion was concerned after our team left. So we thought our next phase would be to do a randomized controlled trial addressing sustainability. And we adapted the original manual from Connie's trial so that school personnel could implement it. And the idea was that we would transfer our skills and knowledge to the school staff and that they would be able to implement it every day and it would be a way for schools to maintain that program once our team left. So we coached these school personnel or aides twice a week during lunch. And this trial was actually conducted in Philadelphia. But while our data is still ongoing, the study is currently still ongoing, what we learned was that we were able to train aides to deliver the intervention and with fidelity. One of my aides told me the other week that her student got invited to his first play date ever in life, and that was really exciting, unsolicited by us, so that was great. However, in conducting all of these trials, what we learned, things went wrong. We were really unprepared for the specific types of challenges that emerged. And some of these barriers were things that we could move around. So the professional development days, the holidays, the field trips, the absences, those are things that we could work around and schedule around. But other things were a little bit more difficult to change. So some of the things that we encountered were the school policies. Some schools in Philadelphia took recess away completely and focused just on academics. We had bad weather in Philadelphia. When it snows or it rains, they get indoor recess, and sometimes they just lose that time altogether because there's just no space to keep all the kids. So the idea is that there were specific challenges that we encountered, but it's the reality of working with under-resourced schools, and it's the reality of working with large public school systems in general. So like I said, working with schools is very challenging. Timing becomes an issue. Not only do we have consents for our kids with autism, we have teacher consents and aide consents and classmate consents to do the friendship survey, as well as peer model consents. So there's a lot of things that we're waiting for other people to return to us. And also, we're limited by the school calendar year. We have 9 months of school. We skip the first month to let the kids kind of form those relationships. And then we start typically in October. Then we lose all the holiday breaks, all the people free days, like I mentioned. And some of the schools in Los Angeles in particular were on tracks. So kids would be in school for 4 weeks and then out for three, then back in for two, and then in out for six. So it became very complicated trying to get in the length of our intervention in those sessions. Not only did we need university IRB approval, but we also needed IRB approval from each school district that we were in. And in some cases, the schools required their individual approvals as well. We also experienced challenges when children changed classrooms in the middle of the school year, that if they were nominated or randomized to a peer-mediated condition, we lost those peer models because we had to start all over. And also in our aide training, we had a lot of staff turnover. Aides were being switched in the middle of the school year to a different child or reassigned, or even, unfortunately, pink slipped because of all the budget cuts that we've been facing. Although all of these environmental changes affect our interventions, it adds authenticity to the type of work that we do. It is what it is, the system is there, and we need to find ways to work with them to improve our social lives of our students. So we know that working with under-resourced schools is very challenging. The specific intervention pieces and processes and components are the same. So what that means is the strategies that we would use to intervene on a particular skill are the same, but the delivery is different, meaning that we need to build into our manuals and our implementation some flexibility. Things happen. In a lot of our schools, we don't have a space where we can conduct our intervention, and a lot of times it's on the go. It's in the hallway, it's in the cafeteria, or whatever it is. And also to fit within the school culture, some of the activities that we typically choose, they need to be fitted to that school environment, to the needs of the child, to the motivation of the child and his or her peers, and so on and so forth. So there needs to be a lot of flexibility built into these interventions that we deliver in schools. And we need to start thinking about how these interventions fit within the school culture and mission. So do the schools value these programs? Are they going to be supported? Are they going to use them? How do these interventions fit within the resources and personnel of the school? Like I showed you earlier, when I have a bunch of cars parked on my playground, it gets very difficult to start implementing some sort of game. So we need to find ways to work around that. In scheduling, it becomes very tricky to kind of get in all the number of sessions that we need to for intervention programs. And what does that mean as far as when we're developing these interventions? We also need to, 1 minute already? Oh, okay. we also need to fit into the beliefs and the values of the teachers and the aides and the children that are participating. And these are all things that we're just beginning to investigate and to learn about, and how we might start to meld all of these issues with the evidence-based interventions and then implement them into schools. So rethinking implementation. When we're designing interventions, you really need to start thinking about partnering with schools to implement interventions. Schools know what works best for them, and they'll know what won't work. So asking them and partnering them, figuring out what it is that they need, is really important when we're designing these interventions to be implemented in schools. Schools might be at different stages. And what that means is some schools might have all the resources available. They might have all the pieces in place for implementation, but others might not. So there needs to be a continuum that we need to work on. And again, it's the reality of studying these issues surrounding implementation. So where we started to turn now are these practice-based evidence models, where we're learning from practice to inform our research. And what we've been doing is turning to schools to learn about their implementation strategies for successful delivery and transference. Some schools out there have adapted evidence-based interventions, and they're implementing them so successfully in their schools, and we need to learn from those schools to inform our research practices. They use their existing infrastructure, their existing personnel, and the resources that they have available to them. And again, they've adapted these evidence-based components to fit within the needs of their school and the needs of their students. And ultimately, all of these things might lead to more feasibility and sustainability in schools once the research team's gone. So we've turned to a couple of local schools in Pennsylvania, and we started looking at what their program's been doing. And I touched on the playground engagement a little bit earlier, but essentially we wanted to evaluate their program to see what kind of social outcomes their students had. And we found an alarmingly high rate of joint engagement in games with rules in their children with autism. And this is about 60% of the time they're joint engaged on the playground, which is about 20% higher than what we achieved in the first peer trial. When we looked at other friendship variables, all of the other variables as far as their outward nominations, how many friends they selected, how many friends that they that chose them as a friend, how many rejections they received, and their friendship reciprocity and connections in the classroom, those were no different from the practice-based evidence and from Connie's original trial. But there was a marginal significant difference between their social networks. So what we're doing as far as the peer media treatments were concerned, there was something that we're doing about changing the friendships in that classroom compared to what was happening in the schools that were adapted their evidence-based practices. So they weren't able to improve the social networks of their children. So where do we go from here? The take-home message is that it is possible to conduct randomized controlled treatment trials in schools to answer really important questions about implementation and child outcomes. We really need to conduct more large-scale school-based trials to build our evidence base, because this area is still relatively new. And we might think about doing that by building partnerships between researchers and schools. As researchers, we might think we have all the answers, but the reality is that schools really will know what was best for them and what meets the needs of their students. All the students on the spectrum, as you guys know, are all different, and so what our program might be to cater towards might not necessarily fit in that school. Working with schools allows us the unique opportunity to examine barriers and facilitators of implementation. Essentially, we need to learn what works and what doesn't, and we need to implement the strategies that do work, and we can either change or move around the strategies that don't. Once we develop interventions that incorporate all of these pieces, we might start to begin to bridge that big gap between what happens in research and what happens in practice. So our current directions, where we're moving now, we have a multi-site randomized controlled trial with the University of Rochester, UCLA, and Penn, and we're really focused on the needs of the schools and the parents. We've been conducting focus groups and asking the parents and schools what it is that they want to see implemented with their children, and we're really focusing on the implementation of evidence-based practices. So I want to take a minute and thank all of the children, parents, aides, teachers, and schools that participate, as well as all the different research assistants and graduate students that helped out in all of these projects. And I also wanted to thank our funders, the Autism Science Foundation, the Health Resources and Service Administration, and NIH. Thank you.
Questions? We have time for a question or two.
I'm Etty Dromi from Tel Aviv. My question regards the social network technique. Do I understand correctly that you video recorded the kids, or did you carry out live observations?
So we gave the students a friendship survey, and they completed the measure on their own. We didn't provide a list of names or faces. They just free recalled and listed kids into groups. And then we coded all those data with a series of matrices and analyses that I can tell you about later.
Thank you.
Essentially, we drew those maps. So who was significantly correlated with each other is basically who came out in those maps.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.